Hey, listeners, before we begin, just quickly, I'd love to tell you about three ways you can support the Pop Culture Preservation Society. As you know, we are an independent podcast. We're not owned or paid by anybody. We do everything by ourselves. And all of our financial support comes from you, the listeners. So if you'd like to help us pay our bills so we can keep on trucking, here's what you can do. One, pledge your support with a recurring monthly donation on Patreon. There are three levels of support, and each one comes with exclusive bonus content. Just go to patreon.com or look for the link in our show notes. Two, subscribe to our YouTube channel. Did you know we had one? Even if you don't have any intention of watching anything on YouTube, do it anyway. Because when we get to a certain level of subscribers, we have a shot at getting a little compensation, and every little bit counts. Three, this one is new. Buy your books using our bookshop.org link. Bookshop.org is an online bookseller that benefits small independent bookstores. And when you use our link, we get a little bit of that love. All of these links will be in our show notes and in our email newsletter and in our link tree. But most importantly, thank you for being here. Thank you for listening and thank you for sharing with your Gen X friends. You are the reason we do this and we couldn't be more grateful to you. Nanu Nanu, keep on trucking and may the force be with you.
Well, he's naked because he got really wet in a rainstorm and they bring him out dry clothes to change.
Oh, I think,
so
yes,
he changes
yes,
on
yes, yes.
Her porch. And all I was thinking was, body of Christ, indeed.
Michelle's been waiting all day.
Yes.
Hello, world. There's a song that we're singing. Come on, get happy. A whole lot of loving is what we'll be bringing. We'll make you happy.
Welcome to the Pop Culture Preservation Society, the podcast for people born in the Big Wheel generation who did not hit the deck and do an army crawl behind the sofa when somebody knocked at the door. They just answered the door.
Hello.
I just did it last night.
We believe our Gen X childhoods gave us unforgettable songs, stories, characters, and images. And if we don't talk about them, they'll disappear like Marshall, Will, and Holly on a routine expedition.
And today, we're saving that very special chapter of small screen history. The shows you wished you could binge watch, but couldn't binge watch because binge watching wasn't possible, the TV miniseries.
I'm Carolyn.
I'm Kristen.
And I'm Michelle. And we are your pop culture preservationists. Before Netflix queues and weekend binges, there was a magical TV phenomenon called the miniseries. And in the 70s and 80s, it ruled the airwaves. These multi-night television events were part epic saga and part national obsession. Truly, you didn't watch them, you committed to them. Families gathered around the wood-paneled console TV like it was a campfire, night after night, hanging on every cliffhanger and dramatic zoom in. And then we had to wait 7 whole days for more. It's torture.
Michelle, I agree with you on most of what you just said, except for the part about families gathering around. Because I have memories, particularly of a miniseries I'm going to share in a little bit, that I was not allowed to watch. But by golly, my mom was going to be watching it. And that's when we were sequestered to like my parents' bedroom and my sister and I would get to watch on the little black and white portable TV because no, Carolyn was not going to watch any little saucy, racy show. Mm-hmm. But you know what Carolyn did when she was back in the room? You better believe I'm changing that channel to the, you know, to the raunchy stuff.
Yeah,
yeah, I got to see why I'm not allowed to be in the living room with my mom.
I was a lot older when I watched most of these that we'll talk about. So I think that's why
it was mom and daughter time.
Yeah, we started being Dallas watching buddies when I was like 10. So,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, anyway, regardless of which miniseries you were watching, this was must-see TV.
It's the epitome of the water cooler moment of old, right? Something that we've kind of been missing in our culture. And they weren't just water cooler moments. These were synchronous water cooler moments. It all happened at the same time for everybody. Mm-hmm. So you wouldn't go to school the next day and they wouldn't be like, no, don't tell me the end because I haven't seen it yet. Everybody's watching it all together.
Yeah. And it wasn't possible for some people to say, oh, I binged all of it. And someone go, no, I'm only on episode two. You couldn't do
that. We live in an asynchronous media landscape right now, and this was so hyper-synchronous.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Everybody's watching the same thing.
Yeah, and it was the marketing of it, because we were all watching the same thing. It was all around us, you know, the trailers on the networks. I remember the, you know, big full-page ads and maybe the TV guide, even on the news, depending on what the miniseries was. It was just an all-encompassing event that really, as we say a lot, kind of brought us all together, because it was we were all experiencing it at the same time.
It was for everybody. We weren't a divided nation. These shows, these miniseries, these events were they were inclusive. Whether or not the content was inclusive, that's beside the point. It doesn't matter.
Right.
It
right.
meant that we were all watching it together, unless you didn't have a TV. I mean, that was the only reason that you wouldn't.
Well, and back to Carolyn's point about not being allowed to watch it, even if you were young and you weren't allowed to watch it, it was still all inclusive, like you're saying, Kristen, because you knew about it.
Yes,
oh,
you
so
did.
If you weren't allowed to watch, you know, the Thornbirds, you knew about you because your parents were probably watching it, or somebody else's mom was watching it.
And you see
and
the commercials.
So you knew enough about it that it still was very inclusive. Everybody knew this was going on for the next 4 weeks. Yeah.
It was something that included every single person in the culture, whether or not they were watching it.
Yeah,
correct. It was still a part of the air that we were breathing.
Well, you know, in just a minute, we're going to go down two very different lists. And I guarantee you, everybody listening is going, if they didn't see it, they know the title of that miniseries.
Exactly.
I haven't seen a lot of these, but boy, I knew what most of them were.
Yeah.
It's
so interesting.
So we could spend the first segment of this episode telling you the history of the miniseries and how it came to be so popular. But you guys, that's really boring. And truly, we know you're all here to hear about Father DeBrickisart's naked ass. So we're going to fast forward to all that good stuff.
I could never say his name. I just didn't. That's the first time I've seen it in print.
Well, I think it's because I just recently watched it and I hear him saying that a lot.
Father
DeBrickisart. So a lot of the information we got for this episode came from one of our favorite magazines. Yes, y'all, I'm talking about a print magazine.
A real magazine.
A real magazine, but it's also a terrific and informative website. And that's Remind Magazine and remindmagazine.com, which it's a really great site for all the retro TV, movie, and celebrity trivia you didn't know you needed. And they also have a lot of really fun quizzes, like how well do you remember Family Ties? Or
really
this
well.
Was my latest favorite, finish the Elvis lyric.
Oh, funny.
We share a lot of these links to remindmagazine.com in our weekly newsletter, The Weekly Reader, because we just think it's a treasure trove of fun facts. And it's just all around fun. Like when I'm looking for a quiz, sometimes I will 30 minutes later come up for air because I've been like,
because you've been taking all of them,
taking all the quizzes. Yeah. So yes, in March of 2024, Remind Magazine dedicated an entire issue to the TV miniseries. And you guys, we love this magazine so much and all the people involved with it that in this week's Weekly Reader, we're going to have a code if you would like to subscribe to Remind Magazine to actually get the magazine in your mailbox. It's super fun. It's also
full
of like crosswords and word finds. Okay, so here is the list that we got from Remind Magazine.
And we're going to walk you through the top 11 miniseries on their list. Yes, 11, because they actually identified the 20 best miniseries of all time. And we thought we'd send numbers 11 through 20 to our Patreon members. But you guys, number 11 is just way too Husker Dewey. So we're going to do the top 11 miniseries of all time. And Patreon members, you'll be getting the entire list, numbers 12 through 20, this week, so you can see just how many of these miniseries you might remember. So what did Remind Magazine put in the number 11 spot?
Okay, number 11, Jesus of Nazareth from 1977. Now, I did not see this, but when I saw Olivia Hussey as Mary, that's, I was like, I feel like I can see these people on a poster or on the cover of a TV guide or something. So this was an international cast and it did include Olivia Hussey as Mary, Anne Bancroft as Mary Magdalene, Ian McShane as Judas. You might know him from Deadwood. Rod Steiger as Pontius Pilate, Peter Ustinov as Herod, and Michael York as John the Baptist. Did you guys watch
I get nervous just at the mention of Jesus of Nazareth. And, and Carolyn's nodding her head. I'm guessing it's for the same reason.
No,
I get nervous
not.
Because Jesus of Nazareth came on TV every Easter. What else came on at Easter?
The Sound of Music.
And I remember being at someone else's house for Easter, and they were saying, well, we should turn the channel. Let's watch. We should be watching Jesus of Nazareth because it's Easter. And I'm like, no, oh my God, no. And I just really, really panicked. I really, really panicked. And I remember having to watch it for a few minutes, but I don't know if there was like, there was a vote that took place, but there was a volume of people who said, this isn't right. We need to watch Sound of Music.
Well, I think when it came out in 1977, my parents made us watch it.
Oh,
that
sure.
That kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So
probably,
at least
yeah.
the first time it came out. And I do remember when I was looking at photos of images from the miniseries, I was like, yes, that's the Jesus in my head that I think of in terms of when he was portrayed on a screen. It's that guy mm-hmm. and his face. And so, yes, we were made made to watch it.
Well, you weren't the only ones because an estimated 90 million U.S. viewers watched the second part when it aired on Easter Sunday in 1977, oh, wow. which is probably why they were like, hey, that's pretty good. Let's keep showing this every Easter.
That's probably the one. That would be the Easter, 1977. I can picture where I was and everything, and that timing lines up that it would be where it's like, no, please don't turn the channel.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you know what? I had this like initial feeling when you said 90 million turned in the second night and not that many the first night. And I was thinking, well, how are they going to know what's going on? And I'm like, oh, well, it is Jesus of Nazareth. I guess they might know a little bit of that earlier story. But I was like, why would you just watch the second night of a miniseries?
Who's this Mary Magdalene person? Yeah. She just comes out of nowhere.
Poof. Okay, number 10. I don't know this one.
I don't
1985,
either.
The Jewel and the
either.
Crown?
Nope. No.
It sounds familiar,
your hand,
but I don't know what
if
it
you
is.
Know. Yeah, The Jewel and the Crown. Number 9, Centennial from 1979. This is a James A. Mishner. Is it Mishner or Mishner?
I always said Mishner.
Mishner, yeah. Mm-hmm. A James A. Mishner gigantic saga, historical
Literally.
Saga. And this was made for the miniseries format. This aired in 12 installments. That's crazy.
It's too much.
It's too much. A lot. That's a huge commitment in terms of like.
I can't do it.
Back then, you wouldn't have been able to like, oh, let me quickly watch the first three episodes if you're only like catching on number four.
Right.
So yeah, that was, but I think it did well, didn't it? In terms of,
I think so.
Probably. Yeah.
I mean, think about it. That is more content than you get in an entire season of a series that is now released on HBO.
Yeah. I know.
So it's hardly mini.
Some of these miniseries, how they're being defined, I guess, is what I'm thinking of, is what you could say, oh, Severance is a miniseries, kind of.
Yeah, now we call it a limited series.
Yeah.
Well, this definitely has more than the three seasons of Severance, for sure. I don't remember watching this, but of course I remember it in the zeitgeist. I remember everybody talking about it. And I have mostly memories of the book, which was like a brick.
Right.
And it was on every coffee table.
Yes.
Every coffee table.
Yeah.
Well, Kristen, if you had tuned in and watched it, I'm just going to tell you a few of the people that were in it. You could have seen Richard Chamberlain. We'll talk
again.
About him. I know
when
he's upcoming. He loved the miniseries.
He did love the miniseries.
You would have Raymond Burr. So you would have Ironside chatting with Brian Keith, Uncle Bill.
Uncle Bill.
Uncle Bill.
And then Chad Everett would come waltzing
you.
In.
Thank you.
Dr. Early?
Yes, from Medical Center. Dennis Weaver, again, McLeod, and Gregory Harrison were some of the people.
Trapper John, M.D.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's everybody. Listen to us just like rattle off those roles.
It's a good cast, but that's too long.
That's too long. It's too long.
Coming in at number 8, and not to be confused with the 1955 film version that starred James Dean, in 1981, we got to see East of Eden. And this was an 8-hour twist on John Steinbeck's novel. And this is kind of known for launching former Bond girl Jane Seymour's career.
Mm-hmm. Oh. Well, thank you. I do remember it. I don't remember, but I don't think that I watched it. But I was aware. I think this was also a learning moment for me, just like Lillian. Linda would have said, well, this is based on the original movie, East of Eden, from 1955, starring blah, 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 blah. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's why I remember
it. Mm-hmm.
It's another one that when I was researching for this episode, I had like three or four that I was like, oh, I'd watch that. It's hard to watch these old miniseries now. It's hard to find them.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. They're not preserved very well.
Mm-mm, no. Okay. And number seven, I'm actually shocked that this is as low it is because it's so massively popular, so massively popular that there was just a very, very like a multi-award winning redo of this past year, and that's Shogun from 1980. It was a 12-hour miniseries. This made history as the first American TV series to be filmed entirely in Japan, with most of the native cast speaking Japanese, often without subtitles. That's when I kind of was like, I think I'll watch last year's. Also starring Richard Chamberlain. He kind of was the king.
Was the king of the miniseries.
You know what? He was the John Sebastian of the miniseries.
Yeah.
Did you guys watch this one, this 1980?
No, that was way over my head. And I was not nearly culturally intelligent enough to have the desire to watch it. And with the new Shogun that just came out, that it won so many awards.
So
and it was
many.
Also the Everything. First something to something. In Japan. I felt so old when this new Shogun came out because it's winning all of these awards. And I felt like a grandma going, isn't that a remake? Because nobody, I was like, don't you remember this? Everybody, don't you remember the original Shogun? But they never referenced it.
I know. That's what made me wonder if it was even related.
I did too. I wondered if I was mistaken and that's just a common term that was applied to two different shows. So it wasn't until I read your backstory here, Michelle, that I understood that it is, in fact, the same show. And yet we live in a time where people have forgotten, like we're the old people now, and they don't even care that something was made before. I'm rambling. Grandma's rambling. But I was just confused.
Go get a Werther's or a brown butterscotch,
a lemon drop.
Grandma.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, did you guys watch this recent one that won all the awards?
Mm-mm.
I was like, oh, hell no. I don't want to watch it. I don't want, just because, sorry, listeners, but I'm not a huge history buff. I should be. It's not something I'm proud of, but it's not like, that's not the miniseries I want to watch. No, give me a good Shrinking or a good, even Severance I loved, but I was like, I have to think too much. Mm-hmm. But when it started winning award after award after award, I have huge FOMO. So now it's on our list of something to maybe watch this summer. Okay, number six, this is from 1978, and this is Holocaust. Mm-hmm. Now, this starred an unknown Meryl Streep. And do you guys remember in our Kramer versus Kramer episode, we mentioned this because she had just done that. She went on to Kramer versus Kramer right after Holocaust. And it won the Emmy for Outstanding Limited Series. I guess they called it Limited Series then, too?
I don't think they did. Oh. But then maybe. I don't know. Okay, don't listen to me.
I don't know. And it, with an audience of 120 million Americans watching some or all, it is credited for bringing the term Holocaust into the vernacular. Thank you, Remind Magazine, because that's a super fun fact.
And that is a really good fact.
Thank you. Let's not say fun when we're talking about the Holocaust.
Yeah. And it is true for me. It is absolutely true for me. I had never heard the word Holocaust before this miniseries. But that's because my parents made me watch it. You know, how many of these are your parents made you watch it? And good for them. And that's one great reason that we have art. But also, I think it was a topic that was very difficult for parents to talk about. And so instead, let's have them watch this show.
Yeah.
And I remember there was special emphasis from my parents on the gas chambers, as if they prepared me for this. And I'm like, what is it about? And they're trying to tell me what it's about. I remember the scene so distinctly of them herding the people into the gas chambers. I'm not going to describe what happened in the gas chambers because it was horrific. And I was really in disbelief. I was just like, is there really this much evil in the world? And if you think about it, I'm watching this in 1978. This happened just 35 years prior.
Oh my gosh.
That means we're talking in today's words, that would be that the Holocaust happened in 1990.
Yeah, like our parents or some of our parents were alive.
Yeah. Yes, when this was happening. So that was eating your vegetables for sure. And I learned Holocaust for the first time, and you can bet I never forgot it.
Mm-hmm. Well, that is definitely one that I flagged to watch again, having just said that I'm not into historical limited series or miniseries. I just feel like that's an important one to watch. Yeah. And Meryl Streep. I know, Carolyn, cover your ears, but I love Meryl Streep. So I would.
Do you not like Meryl Streep?
Well, she, yeah, I kind of said she kind of annoys me a little bit. She's like my Adele. Like, I appreciate kind of what she does a little. I mean, she's growing on me as she gets older, I guess.
And number five, we have a tie, which makes me wonder if Kristen works for Remind Magazine.
It's just math.
Did you do the math?
Can't control the math.
It's a tie between The Winds of War of 1983 and War and Remembrance from 1988.
Which I would have told you was the same miniseries.
Absolutely.
It's not the same.
It's about a war.
Yeah, there's some war.
There's some war, and there's probably people fall in love. I have a memory of it, not watching it necessarily, but it being like background, like whether it was on my TV in my bedroom, like because the 1983 would have been my senior year of high school, and I feel like I had a TV in my room that could have been on, but I was over at my desk, you know, doing some homework or something. So it's there, but not like I was following the plot line.
Well, remember how we talked about before we started this list about how it was, even watching it or not watching it, it was a collective experience.
Yeah, right.
That's how definitely The Winds of War and War and Remembrance, and even going back to North and South, were for me. I didn't watch them, but I have very strong memories of them being talked about, of hearing about them on, I don't know, The Tonight Show if I was watching it, or Letterman, or seeing it on the cover of a magazine. I mean, for sure. So it still is a collective. We can't, we still can't deny
it's still collective.
The collective.
You still knew everybody who was in it. You knew if people liked it or didn't like it. Yeah.
All right. And coming in at number four is one that I flagged to really try to watch. I hope Carolyn's going to tell me where I can watch it, only because it had, it sounded like a really intriguing storyline and has a really good cast. What's that, Carolyn?
So this would be what is often considered the first major miniseries in U.S. television. And this would be Rich Man, Poor Man, 1976. To answer your question, Michelle, you cannot find it anywhere.
Okay.
Oh, no.
It actually, you can find book two. So there was the original miniseries, which was basically book one. It was very successful. And we'll talk about that in a minute. And then they decided, oh, we're going to ride those coattails. There wasn't even a book two at the time, I don't think, but they quickly put something together for the next season that did not do well. And Eight Is Enough came in and took its place on ABC. So in February and March of 1976 is when it, Rich Man, Poor Man initially aired. It was the second most watched TV show of the entire 1975-76 television season. Wow. Number one was All in the Family, and then Rich Man, Poor Man.
Okay? Wow.
This was actually a book first by Irwin Shaw. And boy, when I looked that book up, I was Husker-dude in such a way. I could see the font, everything. My mom had that book. There was a lot of these miniseries, actually.
Yes.
I can see the paperbacks sitting in different places in my home. But for some reason, that Rich Man, Poor Man, you know what it was? I'm having a moment here, listeners. I'm thinking, I knew there was some saucy stuff about this one, because this was one I was not allowed to watch. And I think the book was on our bookshelf. So I maybe pulled the book down
or off
the bookshelf and started going through and looking for words like penis or nude or
nipple.
Something.
Yep.
That's perhaps why that cover is so ingrained in my head. I'm just coming to this moment right now because, I was...
Lillian's like, why are these certain sections of my book all like pulpy?
Penis
and
circles. Yes.
And there's like, is that grape jam on that page?
Well, Rich Man, Poor Man tells the story of the Jordache family. And this is pre-Jordache jeans.
Of jeans?
Oh, really?
No, it's not a true story.
It's just a coincidence.
Yeah.
Okay.
The story of the Jordache family, and it focused on the contrasting lives of two brothers, Rudy and Tom. Rudy was the ambitious, well-educated son who pursues corporate success, while Tom struggles with poverty. He turns to boxing, and he has years of conflict and jealousy, and there's just a lot of heartbreak between these two. Now, the cast, you're going to recognize these names, but at the time, they were not that recognizable. Peter Strauss was probably the most well-known actor in this series when it came out. And he played the role of Rudy. Tom was played by a young Nick Nolte, and this was his major role.
Okay.
He was cute, too.
Yep,
I do remember that.
He was. And do you remember, there's probably because I was in the bedroom flipping the channels. But one of the iconic scenes is kind of like him in a bathtub. I mean, you know he's nude, yes. And it gets pretty close to knowing he's nude. Like, you know, obviously they don't show everything, but it was pretty risque. And so that's how I remember seeing.
Is he drunk or something?
Probably.
There's something clandestine happening. Mm. He's like down on his luck.
Yeah, he's kind of always down on his luck.
Yeah, and then I remember this scene.
Susan Blakely, who, well, I mean, I grew to know her. She became a little more famous after Rich Man, Poor Man. But she was the female lead of Rich Man, Poor Man. And so you guys have to remember, in 1976, the TV audiences were really accustomed to more wholesome programming. Mm-hmm. Think like this was the years of Laverne and Shirley and Happy Days and The Waltons, The Mary Tyler Moore Show, Welcome Back, Kotter. I mean, basically our lives, Bionic Woman, $6 Million Man. So Rich Man, Poor Man was considered scandalous and salacious, with scenes such as Tom telling Rudy he better nail Judy before someone else does. Axel calling Tom's French teacher a slut for letting her boobs hang out.
So they said the words slut and boobs
hang
on
out.
The show.
On the show.
Okay.
And, before he viciously slaps her.
Whoa.
And then Julie, that was the main female character, so Susan Blakely, coming this close to sleeping with an African-American character named Arnold.
Mm-hmm.
But in 1970.
Tame.
By when you think about standards.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. But 1976, this got the, you know, mature warning and all of that kind of stuff I hear. So, yes, again, you guys, I was in the bedroom watching this with my sister, and I might have even planted Ronnie by the door and said, tell me if you hear mom coming. And I'd have my hand like on the dial. I have memories of this. I'll need to ask Ronnie if she does. But could you imagine, like, when my mom was so insistent on, one, she was going to watch it. Two, there was no way we were allowed to watch it. And I'm sure I saw ads and things like that in the TV guides.
Oh,
and it probably said, whatever. And so, of course, that meant I needed to watch it.
Well, and there are probably kids in your class who were watching it.
Well, there probably were.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But, you know, tell me.
I always say, if you want your child to read something, tell them they can't read it. They're not allowed.
Right. And here, I mean, I'm 10, 11 right now, so I kind of know what's going on, and all I want to do is like find the stuff and read about it because mom's
not
going to
circle the
me.
Word penis.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that was Rich Man, Poor Man for you guys.
Well, coming in at number three is a miniseries that I automatically think of when I think of the TV miniseries of the 80s, and that's The Thornbirds. The Thornbirds aired from March 27th to March 30th, 1983. It was four parts, so you didn't have to wait a whole week. It was just night. At the time, it was the second most widely watched television miniseries in history behind Roots. Did you guys watch when it was on?
I can't believe I didn't watch it. I don't know why I didn't. I certainly knew everything about it, and I thought it was sexy as hell. I didn't read the book. I didn't. Maybe it was because my mom was into it, and I was differentiating. That's very possible because I know my mom watched.
Yeah, I definitely have memories of my mom reading the book because I remember the cover. And I also know that I watched it with her. I was in eighth grade, so I think that's okay. That's pretty appropriate. Because I remember, yes, I remember this very forbidden subject matter. I remember my mom almost like gasping audibly at Richard Chamberlain.
Oh my God.
She loved Richard Chamberlain. He was not out yet. He came out publicly. As a gay man in his 2003 memoir called Shattered Love. And this is sad. He had previously been outed by a French magazine in 1989, but he didn't publicly confirm or deny it until his own memoir, until he could do it himself. But my mom, even if she was like, he might be gay, she didn't care. She was like, he is gorgeous. Shocked by this? All right. So The Thornbirds is based on the 1977 Australian novel by Colleen McCullough that we all, like I said, saw our mothers reading, most likely. And Richard Chamberlain stars as Father Ralph de Bricassart, and he's forced to make a choice between his vows to God and his inappropriate feelings. And don't worry, we're going to circle back to that in just a minute. Let's put a pin in that shall we say. It's set in the early 1900s on a sheep station in the Australian outback called Drogheda, sure. which after yeah. watching only one episode, if it was a drinking game, I would still be drunk a week later, as many times as they say Drogheda. And it follows the members of the Cleary family who move to a sheep station, which is run by big sister Mary Cleary, who's played by Barbara Stanwyck, which leads to a, shall we say, pivotal relationship between young Maggie Cleary and father Ralph DeBrickisart when he recognizes that Maggie is neglected basically by her mother, Fiona, who truly is only obsessed with one child, the bastard Frank. And I say that because Frank actually is a bastard, and it's a big shocking revelation.
Yeah.
Well, Father Ralph and Maggie's relationship, it starts off fairly innocent. We don't really get creepy vibes until about half an hour in, or the exact moment he lays eyes on 11-year-old Maggie, and he locks eyes with her, and he cups her face in his hand. And then he inexplicably carries her into the house. She's an 11-year-old child, and he's carrying her like a little baby into the house. And I just felt like that's creepy and wrong and unnecessary. It's unnecessary. Yes. She can walk.
Mm-hmm. And also, they're trying to portray this as a love story, not an inappropriate story. It's a love story.
Well, but they have to build up because it's not till the very end of episode one that she becomes of age. So we have to, this whole grooming process, which I'm calling it because it is, I think we have to get little, signs of that. I don't know. But I do think we can all agree that young Maggie is adorable and she's innocent in all this grooming, played so well by a young actress named Sydney Penney. I don't know if you guys, if that brings back any memories, but she is Mm-mm. so cute. And I'm going to use one of Kristen's words because it's so true. She's earnest in all of her scenes. Mm-hmm. She received a total of 6 Young Artist Awards nominations, winning 2 for playing young Maggie Cleary. She also was in Pale Rider. She starred in the sitcom The New Gidget from 1986 to 1988. She was the New Gidget. I don't know if I remember that little sitcom. She also, in the 90s, was on the soap Santa Barbara. She was BJ Walker. She received a Daytime Emmy Award for Outstanding Younger Actress. Then she was on All My Children. She was Julia Santos Kiefer, and she got a Daytime Emmy Award for that as well.
Husker Du. Yeah.
Or she got a nomination.
Now I know her. Yeah.
Well, episode one Julia. That I watched, it really does set everything up for us and gives us all the information we'll need going forward. Besides the growing attraction between the good father and young Maggie, and I'm sorry, but making us try to buy Rachel Ward as an 18-year-old Maggie doesn't work. Yeah. And it's still gross. She's 18. Yeah. It's still gross.
But it's so weird. Nobody thought
that's
that.
That's what I'm saying. No. I thought it was. It's just crazy.
Well, it's so did our moms, stories. I guess, and all the people who read the book.
Well, besides that, we get to see old lady Barbara Stanwyck come on to the sexy father multiple times, once when he's naked on her porch.
Why?
Well, he's naked because he got really wet in a rainstorm, and they bring him out dry clothes to change.
So he changes on
her porch, and all I was thinking was, body of Christ indeed.
Michelle's been waiting all day.
You guys, he's got a really good butt. He just does. But you see his butt. He's got one leg up
I remember
on the chair
the butt.
Drying his
yes.
legs.
Yep.
Well,
yep.
Barbara Stanwyck, who's Mary Cleary, and she's probably supposed to be like 80, I mean, she comes out and she's running her hands all over his chest and he's just standing there naked. He doesn't try to cover up. So all the stuff that I'm like, oh no, yuck. Attraction between Maggie and Father Ralph grows and becomes passionate and forbidden, and it turns into a full-blown love affair. But then Maggie marries Luke O'Brien, who's played by Brian Brown, who she marries in real life, fun fact, to try to forget Father Ralph. But let's be real, no one can forget that body, right? Body, like I said, body of Christ.
The Ding. Fact that his name is Father Ralph.
I know, right? Because forever.
It's just too on the nose.
Well,
yeah, it's too
her
forever.
Her marriage doesn't work out because it's abusive. And let's not forget, she's sleeping with the priest who basically raised her.
Oh, jeez.
Oh, my God. Which leads to, you guessed it, the baby Jesus. But she names him Dane.
God.
So meanwhile, Father Ralph, who is unaware he's a father of a different kind now, he develops a close relationship to Dane as he grows, much like he did with Maggie. Not like really like that, but sort of the yeah, same know, like the, father mm-hmm. figure. Father is yeah. another, could be a drinking game here. And I really feel like we can see where this is going. Okay, so the father does take Dane, because remember, he's the father, but he's also a father. Yeah,
he's
okay.
the father.
Good. You guys mm-hmm. are keeping father, father. Up. Yeah. I'm proud of you.
Yep.
So the father, he does end up taking Dane to Rome to study for the priesthood. But it's not until after Dane tragically drowns while trying to save two women that Maggie finally tells him that he's not just a Catholic father, but he's Dane's father. Harsh, right?
Oh, he didn't know.
He didn't know at all. Anyway, after he finds out, basically at the funeral, she tells him, which is such bad timing. But he's so overcome with grief that he has a heart attack and dies.
The end.
Spoiler, sorry.
Uh-huh. Can't you just see him like getting Dane ready for the priesthood? And he's like, don't worry about the celibacy part, because that's not real.
You know what?
You can have sex with whoever you want.
I used to sleep with your mom from the time she was 18.
Yeah. How old are
it
you
again?
It was
fine. Yeah, exactly. Oh, you guys.
Yeah, that was
And then there's
epic.
Parts in it as this whole grooming thing. And I know, you know, she is neglected by her parents. So she thinks she's dying when she gets her period. But it's Father Ralph who has to tell her about sex and and he tells her about all this stuff. And she's like, well, will I have your baby when we get married one day and all this stuff? And he's like, oh, dear child. But he's like looking at her just a beat too long every time.
I do have to watch it now. I have to
I
watch
feel like
it.
We need
it's
to
available
do...
on Amazon Prime, yes. okay. and you guys have to buy each episode for $6.
Oh.
Well, it's okay. It was well worth my $6, okay. but I didn't continue on because, one, I ran out of time, and two, I'm like, I know where this story's going.
Yeah.
And I honestly, you guys, I don't think I could have watched the sex part. Mm. It's too creepy for me, especially now being an adult and watching how... I'm sorry, lovers of Thornbirds who disagree with me, feel free to disagree with me, but I am sorry, I'm going to say it again. I feel like he groomed that child.
Yeah. Well, okay. We have to ask why. It's worth asking the question, why did our moms love this? And it could just be exactly because it was disgusting or because it was clandestine or it was forbidden.
Forbidden.
It's not something you would ever want to see in real life, but when it's in imaginary life, then it's very titillating.
Has it ever felt like you're doing everything right, eating healthy, working out, but your energy still crashes or those wonky mood swings hit out of nowhere?
Oh, yes. But I've got to tell you, Michelle, that has gotten so much better since I have been taking Hormone Harmony. It really does make a difference. And I recently took their free 2-minute quiz. I learned that menopause can have my hormones all out of whack. Hormone Harmony helps to fine-tune my hormonal system, and it helps maintain optimal hormone levels. It's helped with my menopause-related brain fog, my quality of sleep, and really overall well-being. I just feel better. And I also feel good knowing they only use proven science-backed ingredients in all of their herbal formulas. And what's great about the quiz is that it will recommend the best product for you based on your answers and your particular hormonal needs.
Yeah, I love that they actually have a whole line for your gut health, like Bloat Banisher. Is that TMI? I don't know. If you're ready to start feeling like yourself again, head over to happymammoth.com and take their free 2-minute hormone quiz today to find the ultimate answer to your stubborn hormonal issues. And for a limited time, you can also get 15% off your entire first order with our code PCPS at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use the code PCPS for 15% off today. The Thornbirds, though, I mean, it deserves its place at number 3 on this list because it was so important at the time. People loved it. It was nominated for 16 Emmys. It won 6. And it was followed by a sequel miniseries in 1996 called The Thornbirds, The Missing Years. I have some fun facts, though, because you know how I love casting. Mm-hmm, this, mm-hmm. Like, almost casted. Because regardless of if you watch this or not, we know these people, right? Mm-hmm. So this is so interesting. The first director was Herbert Ross, and he saw Christopher Reeve about playing the lead of Father DeBernard.
I could see that.
Yes,
but then,
I do. I like
so
that.
They took a meeting,
if you
will.
I like that.
Okay. Well, guess what? Herbert Ross then was out. Peter Weir became attached to direct, and his favorite for Father DeBernard was Robert Redford.
No.
No.
No. Okay, no. Mm-mm. So no. So yes, Christopher Plummer. Yeah.
No, Christopher Reeve.
Oh, Christopher Reeve. I'm sorry.
Christopher Reeve.
Christopher Plummer.
Yeah, not Georg.
Mm. Yeah. So then Peter Weir drops out as director. Oh, what was happening behind the scenes, right? And Arthur Hiller comes in to direct. And he wants Ryan O'Neill to be father to Bricusart.
Absolutely not.
Oh, see, I could see that.
Oh, no.
I could see that one.
Well, maybe it's because I'm not used to, this is weird, blonde Catholic people? I don't know.
Well, I will say Richard Chamberlain's hair was kind of a light brown. It wasn't like dark brown. Yeah. It's
mine
almost like a dark blonde.
Has nothing to do with hair color, I don't think. But Ryan O'Neill to me was like love story. And it was, he wasn't
He's playful.
Well, I will say it all. Yeah. In all the scenes, like all the village women in Australia come on to Father de Bricusart, to Richard Chamberlain. I mean, it's out in the open and he doesn't really shy away from it. He plays into their jokes and their innuendos and stuff.
Father, what a waste.
Well, so eventually, so. Okay. The role of Maggie became the most sought after role of the production. Some say it was considered the role of a lifetime. And here are some other actresses who auditioned for the part. Michelle Pfeiffer.
Mm-hmm.
Jane Seymour.
Oh, yes.
Olivia Newton-John.
No.
Not right after Grease.
No way.
No. I'm going to say heck after I've just been talking about grooming and and Kim Basinger. Bassinger.
I think it's, who knows?
I don't like any of those, to be honest with
that
you.
That kind of works, but Rachel Ward was just perfection.
She was.
Yeah. She really was perfection.
Yeah, she was, except for, like I say, that first ball when it's like 6 years, you get the little 6 years later.
Yeah.
It's like the little SpongeBob thing. 6 years later. And here she comes, and everyone's gasping. Mm-hmm. She's a beautiful woman, but I'm sorry, she's not 18. So coming in number two, another big name miniseries, mm-hmm. I think. If you didn't watch it, you know this one, and that's Lonesome Dove from 1989.
Mm-hmm. It's so funny that I think the theme of this show is, even if you didn't watch it, you still knew about it.
Right. I think in 20, has there only been maybe four that we were
exactly.
Like, I don't know, QB the seventh. Yeah.
And the number one thing I know from Lonesome Dove is Ricky Schroeder. That's the number one thing that I know, because it was the first time we saw him since Silver Spoons. And you're like,
that's right.
He's a man. Mm-hmm. Look at him. He grew up. And he might have been Rick Schroeder. I don't remember.
I think he was.
Did he transfer over? And I'm like, get over yourself, Ricky Schroeder. Go drive your little bed car or whatever it is.
Ride your little train through your living room. Diane Lane was also in Lonesome Dove. All right, well, let's go down. Drum roll, please.
You know Kristen, what's coming.
Kristen, you got to take mm-hmm. us to the
you
number
know, everybody
one
knows.
Miniseries. And it's, I mean, obviously,
it's
right?
obvious. If Thornbirds isn't the number one miniseries, what is the number one miniseries of all time, according to Remind Magazine? But let's be honest, according to the American public, the number one miniseries of all time is Roots. Roots, of course, is the iconic 1977 miniseries based on Alex Haley's book called Roots, The Saga of an American Family, which traces his story, the story of his family, from its roots in Africa through slavery and into freedom. He eventually, I think most people know this, he eventually admitted that not all of the book was factual. Mm. It's possible that he borrowed/plagiarized from somebody else's work. Yeah. And admittedly so. He said, yes, this is true. And he started calling the book a work of faction. So fact plus some fictionalized parts of it. And he had to pay a settlement for that. And he didn't try to deny it. So he takes responsibility for that. Even so, the miniseries, possibly even more than the book, is what made an impact on our culture. It's possibly mm-hmm. the first miniseries that many Gen Xers remember. Mm-hmm. It might be the first thing in their consciousness that has to do with a miniseries, because it was a cultural and educational event for everybody, not just for adults, but for children also. Many kids were given extra credit for watching it. Mm-hmm. Many kids were assigned watching it as homework. And that's because it wasn't just the story of slavery in America. We had lots of sources about slavery, right? We learned about slavery in school. It was the first story of this breadth and depth about slavery that was told from the perspective of the Africans. And that had never been done before. So Roots aired on 8 consecutive nights on ABC from January 23rd until January 30th, 1977. And this was on purpose. Instead of releasing one episode a week, like a normal miniseries, as it was done at the time, TV execs did this essentially to get it out of the way, to get it over with. So feared the public's reaction that they said, just air it and we'll move past it. They were very worried about sweeps week. They were like, let's just cut our losses, get it. They were certain it was going to be a flop. They thought this was going to be a flop.
Aren't they the same people that would have had to greenlight it?
Yes. Yes. There's a lot of push me, pull you going on right here. And it wasn't the racism that they were worried about. It was the unflinching portrayals of really horrific realities that they feared. They just didn't think that the American public had the stomach for it. And they were afraid that they would turn the channel. So they believed in the project. They feared America's reaction to it. But Alex Haley and the writers, many of whom were Black, which was not common for the 70s, it's not a lot of them, it's not all of them by any means, but they were present and Alex Haley was in that writer's room. They felt that watering it down would be a disservice. So they were just like, no, we're just going to show it exactly as it happened, because they were here to tell a story of what actually happened and they weren't going to pretend that it didn't. And they really did, you guys. Oh, I had forgotten. It was difficult. Mm-hmm. Even in just the first few minutes of the show, there are things that you did not see on television normally, including bare breasts. They showed bare breasts on TV. And I do remember that and it was not sexual. It's women in an African tribe, like gathering water and carrying their children. Yeah. It's all done in a very wholesome and organic and realistic way. So we weren't titillated. I was just a little it was a cultural moment for me going, don't overreact, don't overreact.
Yes. Just,
this is strange, but don't overreact. But the TV executives needn't have worried, because the first episode drew 29 million people, and every night the audience got bigger and bigger and bigger until the final episode, which was viewed by 100 million people. So that was an 80% share of the viewing audience.
Wow.
So in total, there were 140 million Americans who watched at least some of Roots, which equals 85% of all homes with a television set.
Wow.
Yes.
Restaurants would close, like depending on events. And I think if you remember, and I can't remember what show it was, maybe it was the Dallas one when who shot JR, but like college classes were canceled, that people and companies and churches took some of this into account and might have said,
yeah,
choir practice is canceled on Wednesday because Roots is on, or, you know, no.
And
whatever.
Everybody knows it's coming because it's in their TV guides and it's been advertised. There are no surprises. Everybody knows. And so that ended up being the largest viewership ever attracted by any type of television series, anything in U.S. history.
Wow.
Yes. And I remember knowing that. And just being sort of in awe of this event that was happening. And part of what made this story so successful on TV was the casting. I really have to hand it to them, because they created a story and characters that stick with people even today.
Yeah.
Basically, everyone in Hollywood was in Roots. Many of them people you would not expect. But most memorably, Roots gave us LeVar Burton as the young Kunta Kinte.
Your name is Toby. You're going to learn to say your name. Let me hear you say it. What's your name?
Kunta Kinte.
Nobody our age will ever forget the name Kunta Kinte. Everybody knows the name Kunta Kinte. They'll never forget LeVar Burton, so much so that when you saw him on Reading Rainbow or on Star Trek, The Next Generation, you're like, that's Kunta Kinte.
Yeah,
like you felt an affinity for him. You knew him so well. He connected so hard with that audience. And we still have warm feelings for LeVar Burton today. So John Amos, who played James Evans, the dad on Good Times, played the older Kunta Kinte. And he says that that role was the role of a lifetime. It was the reason that he was put on this earth, essentially. And this is some real sweet I don't want to say revenge. That's too strong of a word. But it's important for him because if you recall, John Amos was very unceremoniously fired from Good Times. Remember, they mm-hmm. killed him in a car accident and he just never came back. Like, why did they have to do it so violently? And yep. they fired him because of John's outspokenness about his dissatisfaction with how Good Times portrayed Black people in America. Mm-hmm. He wanted to tell real stories that told the truth and made an impact. And instead, he got JJ. And so Roots was the story he needed to tell, and he did it unforgettably. So TV execs took a really big risk, and they cast some of America's most beloved actors in the most heinous roles as slaveholders and traitors because they – and traitors, not traitors, but like slave traitors – because they wanted to soften the blow for the watching audience. And this is according to the Museum of Broadcast Communications. They said that they put actors like Lorne Greene, Lloyd Bridges, Robert Reed, aka Mike Brady, Ralph Waite from The Waltons, Daddy Man from The Waltons, Sandy Duncan, a young Tracy Gold plays the young Sandy Duncan. And you guys, Burl Ives in these white secondary roles. And they did that to reassure audiences. And these white characters were featured very prominently in the commercials, disproportionately, because Roots was not their story. But they wanted to reassure the white audience that this show is for you. They even created a new character that wasn't in the book to be played by Ed Asner. Again, a beloved person that will reassure the audience. And he was cast as a slave ship captain who was having sort of a crisis of conscience about what he was doing. Really the only white person in the trade of the slave trade who showed any sort of moral compass. Oh my God, Daddy Man Walton, he's a horrible character. It's bad. It's really bad. And it was hard to watch Daddy John Walton say those things. So yeah, he's having a real crisis of conscience about what he's doing. And this role was created to help white audiences feel better about their role in history. They wanted white people to feel better that their ancestors weren't all 100% villains, that there were some good people. They did not want to scare the white people away. And so this was to communicate to them that it would be safe to watch. But the real stars of the show, the people we remember, are the people from whom Alex Haley was descended. Those are the characters we remember, like LeVar Burton, like John Amos. But listen to the rest of this cast list. It's astounding. James Earl Jones plays Alex Haley. Maya Angelou plays one of the women in Kunta Kinte's tribe. Scatman Crothers plays Mingo. Louis Gossett Jr. plays Fiddler. Richard Roundtree, who played Shaft, he plays Sam. O.J. Simpson. Lawrence Hilton Jacobs. Boom Boom Washington from Welcome Back, Kotter. So Boom Boom plays an important role. Cicely Tyson, bless her heart, plays Kunta Kinte's mother. Leslie Uggams as Kizzy. And Ben Vereen as Chicken George. Everybody remember Chicken George?
I gotta go rewatch this now.
I know. Todd Bridges plays a role. Roxy Roker plays a role. Everybody in Hollywood had an important role. And in 2023, Variety ranked Roots as the number 10, the 10th greatest TV show of all time.
Wow.
Of any TV show. Yes.
Oh, I would really? Say. Yeah.
Actually,
I don't know why I feel like that's, that seems low. But
so impactful. I mean, that
so
was.
So impactful.
I can remember. Yes. Like, if I close my eyes, I can see when LeVar Burton is getting, you know, whipped.
Yes.
And those scars. And, oh, my gosh. And his mother and Kizzy and listeners, well, if you watch this on YouTube, you'll see I'm closing my eyes. But yeah, that really impacted me as a 12-year-old. And I'm sure there was like the extra credit and stuff involved too. Mm-hmm. So it's like, we're watching this tonight, family, even if maybe we weren't going to.
If I recall correctly, I think I may have watched the first episode, and it could be that my parents were like, this is intense. And it might be too intense for an 8-year-old. And because I don't remember, I just remember snippets then of the rest of it, but I didn't sit down every single night. It was not like.
Kristen, go watch Love, American and Style.
Yes, right.
Yeah, that's right. Go watch your soaps. What I remember very specifically, I think it would have been 78 because we would have moved to New Jersey, but we had it on a film strip. in my classroom. Wow. So it was like a still, you know, there'd be a still photo from the show. There was some recording playing and there was the beep. And I remember thinking when we were getting ready to watch it as a class, having watched it on television, like, how on earth is this going to be a film strip? And all I can remember is these still photos and the beep. And thinking, this is not at all
like it was.
Like, what a disservice in a way.
Yeah.
They were doing. But yeah, it was a film strip.
Because you can't deliver the intensity. You can't. I mean, think of the emotions on LeVar Burton's face. That is what sold it for everybody. It's like that. It's the same as the photo of John Lewis getting beaten with a baton on the head. The look on his face when he's looking up into the sheriff's eyes. It's the look on LeVar Burton's face that helps us understand the pain and anguish that is involved, that the injustices that are being done. I looked at some things on YouTube about Roots, and comment after comment after comment was one of the most impactful things I've ever seen. One of the most important things I've ever watched. Saw this as a child. Had this assigned in history. I've never been the same. It was universally accepted that people were changed forever after watching Roots.
All right, you guys ready to switch gears a little bit? So if the miniseries of the 70s and the early 80s were basically history lessons, like you were just saying, the Holocaust and Roots, and the mid to late 80s and the early 90s took a hard 180 and brought us a bunch of miniseries full of big hair, bold shoulder pads, and big scandal. This was the era of the romance novel miniseries, and it was truly escapism at its finest. God bless. Mm-hmm. Think Sidney Sheldon, Judith Krantz, and Jackie Collins. These miniseries delivered all the drama and all the sex you could want. Jet-setting billionaires, love triangles, revenge plots, family feuds, affairs, secret children, and lust. So much lust. Hold on. Did I just describe the Thornbirds
again?
Pretty
much, yeah. Yes. Just in Australia.
Do you guys remember watching these romance novel miniseries?
This is very similar to all of the other miniseries where I remember their existence of them. And I was very aware that they came from books. I would be so excited to be like, oh, the Danielle Steele's new one is going to be a movie. It was almost like you waited for it to be a movie. And yet I didn't tune in, but I was very aware of them.
Right. I think same with me, Kristen. When I look at the years of these, this is when I was out also getting the $3 pitchers of beer lots of times. Like, I was not staying home watching television. So, I don't remember any specific except Rage of Angels by Sidney Sheldon.
Oh,
so
yeah, that's
right. I will tell you that I read that book. I read that book long before it was the miniseries or TV movie. I remember... You guys, I'm not lying when I say this. I thought it was the best book I had ever read. I was so, I can't tell you. I had to
read about many
every Sidney Sheldon book there ever was. Like The Other Side of Midnight. I mean, you name them. I was in love. And I felt like I'd crossed some threshold into adult reading.
Yes.
It just had me on the edge of my seat. I was a Sidney Sheldon fan. And fun fact, he didn't even start writing those novels until he was in his 50s. He was a TV writer and creator before that. I mean, we have him to thank for I Dream of Jeannie.
That's right. I'm so confused by all of that because I knew those two names. I mean, one name. I knew the one name and I saw them in these two very disparate places. And I always assumed they were two different people with the same name.
Yeah. No.
That's crazy.
I know. That's a good fact. Well, I was not of the age to be buying $3 beers at the time. I was in the perfect age to be just soaking all of these types of miniseries in. And let's not forget my mom, who wanted a Dallas watching buddy when the buddy was only 10, loved these types of miniseries too. So we would get very excited. And my mom had probably read a lot of these books. And not only did our friend Shane, who's 87 Ragged Tiger on Instagram, not only did he watch all these and currently owns recordings of many of them, he told me yesterday that this list I'm about to share was basically his entire high school reading list. one of his best friends reminded him that when they were in high school, Shane used to just carry around a copy of The Thornbirds. Oh, he said he never read it. He just wanted to look cool.
Isn't that hilarious? That is fantastic.
That's what I said. I know Shane's like, God, I was a mess. I was like, this is gold. I was like, could I please share this on the podcast? And he's like, haha, absolutely.
That's some very committed identity making.
I love that. Yeah. Right? It's just one more reason that I'm like, Shane, we would have been, I wish we would have known each other in high school. We would have been besties.
I would have seen that guy carrying that Thornbirds, and I would have been like, I'm going to go sit at his lunch table.
And let's not forget, let's go all the way back to Shane's the little boy who carried around stacks of Hardy Boys, didn't read them. Right. But he did it so his mom would let him put posters of Sean Cassidy on his wall.
So brilliant.
So smart. So brilliant. Well, okay, so here is a list of the most unforgettable of these 1980s romance novel miniseries in no particular order, people. So don't come at me if you're like, you said that one last. We know you remember these and you have feelings about these. So in 1986, Carolyn, it was a Sidney Sheldon adaptation, If Tomorrow Comes, and it was a revenge thriller meets globe-trotting romance starring Madeline Smith. Do you guys know who that is?
Okay, I'm just reading this in your notes, and I'm gobsmacked.
It's Pam from Urban Cowboy.
And I wonder if this is why she looks so familiar to me in Urban Cowboy. Maybe I watched If Tomorrow Comes.
Maybe, yeah.
Maybe. Because I knew her. I definitely knew her, and I'd never seen Urban Cowboy before.
Carolyn, you'll have to talk to Shane about this. This is his very favorite. He owns a signed first edition copy of If Tomorrow Comes.
Of course he does.
He has such good collection.
Okay, another one that I remember only because, again, Shane has been asking us for like 3.5 years, when are you going to do an episode on? When are you going to do an episode on? Lace, the 1984 miniseries starring Phoebe Cates and Bess Armstrong from 1984.
I think I did see this. Because I love those two women, Phoebe Cates and Bess Armstrong.
This is a scandal-filled tale of four women and a daughter in search of her mysterious mother. This is the miniseries that's famous for the line, which one of you bitches is my mother? I love that line.
I think I saw this. I'm pretty sure I saw this one. This is delicious.
Delicious is a great word. So I immediately was like, I'm watching that before we record this episode. Hard to find again. I think you might be able to buy it. It said it was on some streaming service called Pivotal. Something that sounded too sketchy for me. God, Tubi, come on, get us Lace. We need Lace. I know, Shane, I know you're listening and we know you own it. So if you want to like bootleg us a copy and send it, we'd be happy to watch it. Okay. Judith Krantz. God, that name. Isn't that just a queen of the romance novel?
Can you see the font on the front of the book?
Yes.
Yeah, the kind of scripty font.
Yeah, so this is the 1980 miniseries Scruples.
Yes. Oh, I can see the cover. Scruples. And she has like the little black, like the net coming off of her hat.
Yes, please.
Coming over her eyes.
I love how you guys are both like, I can see it because you can.
Yes.
You know, a lot of our followers on social media say when we post something on Instagram that's like an Avon bottle or Tickle deodorant, they'll say, I can smell this post. I can smell this. Because so many of these memories are so olfactory or visual in this case of what we're doing. Because when I was writing down these notes for this episode, I was Googling and the images would come up. And I was like,
yes.
Because you can see them. Well, Scruples is the rags to riches fashion saga. I love it's a fashion saga. Following a woman's rise in Beverly Hills high society, starring Lindsay Wagner and Barry Bostwick. Come on. You know Barry Bostwick from Spin City, but from the Rocky Horror Picture Show. Yes. Those of you that are Rocky Horror, big Rocky Horror people. Were you guys? I missed that whole craze. I saw it. I mean, I went in high school.
I went, I don't know, three or four times
and threw, you know, toast at the screen and stuff. But we never, like, got into the whole I'm going to travel around the world. And
I've never seen it in the theater. I've only seen it, like, in
You
got to
see it in the theater.
Room.
It is an experience because
I've never
you
had
want
that
to go and you want to watch everybody else in that theater. So we went to, like, two midnight showings in high school, and we didn't know to dress up or anything, but we knew enough to bring like the water gun. You have to squirt water at one point, and anyway,
that was when my cool aunt was going to take me to Rocky Horror, and my mom said no.
Yeah,
and I'm still mad
bizarre.
About it.
Okay, another Judith Krantz from 1987. I'll Take Manhattan. Now, this one I have very clear memories of because it starred Valerie Bertinelli, and we. All had a girl crush on Valerie Bertinelli. Mm-hmm. What? Listeners, we know you probably had a girl crush on Valerie Bertinelli, but in 1987, we haven't seen her in a while, right? She's been in these little made-for-TV movies and stuff along the way. But man, I was watching this one. She played Maxie Amberville. She tries to save the magazine empire her father built, but her treacherous uncle stands in the way. Jane Kaczmarek is in this one, Jack Scalia, Julianne Moore, and once again, Barry Boswick. Now, do you guys, these are all love like Judith Krantz, but do you remember Princess Daisy from 1983?
I don't remember this title. I remember everything else looks so familiar, and this one is not.
I remember
definitely
the title.
I bet it's because I'm looking at the year going, I bet it's because I read it. I bet it's because my mom read it. And then I probably grabbed her little trade paperback later and read it.
Yep.
Okay. So like I said, Judith Krantz, this is a tragic fairy tale about a beautiful heiress coping with love, loss, and secrets. This stars Robert Urich, Rupert Everett, Stacey Keach, and Lindsay Wagner. She's coming back again too.
So she's got a life after the Bionic Woman.
Yeah, no Barry Bostwick in this one, though. Sorry. And then now we're going to get to a Jackie Collins one. Because Jackie Collins, too. Come on, right? The queen also of these 1980s romance. And, you know, they're thick and they're like little brick. They're just a little brick.
Yeah, they are.
I can't read them now. I can't. Even with my readers, I
can't. I don't know how our moms read them.
No, I couldn't.
Well, they were young.
The print's too small.
When my mom was reading all of these, she was probably in her late 30s.
Yeah, my mom was probably in her 40s, but I don't even know if I could have read them then. It was so small. The paper was like newsprint. If you got it wet, if you like dripped sweat on it or your something from your drink, then the letters from the other side came through.
And if you left it in the window and it rained, it would swell up like,
that's right.
Like a
balloon.
That's
right. It was all warped during waves.
Yes. Yes. It did, though. That's exactly the way you describe it. Yeah. Well, Hollywood Wives, based on the Jackie Collins novel, was in 1985. And this is odd. It centers around the glitz, gossip, and betrayal in the lives of Hollywood's Rich and Restless, starring Candace Bergen, another actress my mother loved. Stephanie Powers,
too.
Oh, we watched Heart to Heart all the time. So we loved Stephanie Powers. Mm-hmm. Anthony Hopkins, what? Angie Dickinson, my mom was a fan of hers as well. And Suzanne Summers, too. So I know we were watching this.
Oh, yeah.
That's a good one. That's another one I might want to watch for just, you know, some guilty pleasure.
Yeah, that could be really good.
And we couldn't include one of these romance novel miniseries without including a Danielle Steele. And that would be 1986's Crossings, which was set in World War II and was a sweeping romance and political drama starring Cheryl Ladd and Lee Horsley. Do you remember what he was in?
I know that name.
Lee Horsley.
Yeah, I would recognize him,
Houston,
but I don't know why.
From 82 to 85. Do you remember the show Matt Houston?
Who's that?
No.
It was a show.
That was a show?
I know. I was like, what is 82, 85? What? Oh, that's its own show. Isn't that funny that we know the actor's name? I definitely know that actor's name, and I've never heard of Matt Houston before. That one didn't get stuck in the old craw.
I can
Matt Houston,
him.
Lee Horsley, Pamela Hensley, Lincoln Kilpatrick, Buddy Ebsen.
What was it about?
Matt Houston is an American crime drama television series starring Lee Horsley as the title character, a wealthy oil man who holds a side job as a private investigator. Oh, you know what? It's an Aaron Spelling show.
Oh, of course.
Produced by Aaron Spelling. It originally aired on ABC for 3 seasons from 82 to 85. I bet you if you saw him and you saw his red convertible and saw, I'm looking right now at Wikipedia at the font where it says Matt Houston. It's like college letter. I bet you would.
Okay.
I love how the synopsis on Wikipedia says Matt Houston stars Lee Horsley as a wealthy mustachioed Texas oil man.
Well, you don't even have to say mustachioed. We knew. Oh, my goodness. That is a lot. That's a lot of TV, you guys.
Yes.
That was a lot of hours of TV. If you add up all of the hours for all of those miniseries, that's a lot of hours of TV. And whether it was the epic battles of Shogun, the sweeping drama of Roots, the misguided and controversial romance of the Thornbirds, or the deliciously trashy and captivating stories of the romance novel adaptations, we didn't even know it was a genre back then, but it's a total genre. These limited-run sagas were cultural touchstones for us, and they brought cinematic storytelling into our living rooms and proved that television could be just as grand, emotional, and unforgettable as what we saw on the silver screen Amen. We hope today's episode brought back memories or sparked your curiosity to visit these iconic shows and you take to the Googles to find one. Thank you today for listening and taking this trip back through television history with us. And we will see you next time.
And we would like to give a special thank you shout out to some of our supporters over on Patreon. We like to name them by name at the end of every episode. And today we're thanking Deb SJS. Now, you have to understand, everyone, that this is just, you know, they put their name in and their email, and sometimes they don't like to put their name, and we respect that. So SJS, big thanks.
Yeah. SJS.
Donovan, MP, Magdalena, Mike, Alice, Miriam, Linda, Richard, Laura, Shannon, Jen, Teresa, and Don.
Thank you, everybody.
Yes, thank you so much. If you don't mind, we'd like to ask you a big favor, okay? Would you mind going and leaving a review of the podcast wherever you listen? Truly, those reviews and ratings help us more than you could ever know. And if you're so in the mood, you can tell some more friends about how great we are and how they might give us a listen as well.
That's the best thing that you can do for us. Yes. Thank you so much. In the meantime, let's raise our glasses for a toast courtesy of the cast of Three's Company. Two good times.
To Richard Chamberlain's ass.
That is happy days.
To Little House on the Prairie.
Cheers. Cheers. Cheers.
The information, opinions, and comments expressed on the Pop Culture Preservation Society podcast belong solely to Carolyn, the Crushologist, and Hello Newman, and are in no way representative of our employers or affiliates. And though we truly believe we are always right, there's always a first time. The PCPS is written, produced, and recorded in Minneapolis, Minnesota, home of the fictional WJM Studios and our beloved Mary Richards. Nanu, nanu, keep on truckin', and may the force be with you.